Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. This is Dr. George, and today I want to have an interesting show regarding artificial intelligence, information technology, and the future of not just our society, but of healthcare in specific. I'm going to have a guest join us about half an hour into the show. But before she comes on, I just wanted to ask, Dave, have you actually heard what's going on? I mean, we talk about Watson and helping it pay your taxes with H&R Block. But this morning I read an article that was really interesting about how it's being used in the court system. So there's some sort of algorithm that this company has come up with that helps judges with sentencing. But it's proprietary. And the person who's, on the hook cannot see what that information is, how it was derived at, because it's proprietary. So you have some black hole computer deciding whether or not you're going to be a menace to society, whether or not you're at risk of recidivism, all sorts of things that go into the sentencing and in the judge being able to make up the sentencing. And it's a black box. It's only as good. This is my thing about the whole computer information system. It's only as good as what the information is that's plugged into it. And even though it's supposed to be, a computer making decisions and taking the human aspect out, it really isn't. It's just being quantitated, monetized, but it always has the beginning. It was created by humans, so it's, by definition, there's a flaw, don't you think? I mean, I wouldn't want to be sentenced based on some sort of algorithm any more than I want to be treated based on some algorithm.
Have we outgrown ourselves?
We're getting there. It's this mentality that we're humans are flawed. Well, of course we are, but that something we can create something. I know no one's perfect except God, and a computer should not take the place of anybody, because they're going to, or it will decide in a very non-emotional, way, all sorts of things about us. How long you serve in jail, whether you get the medication, whether you get the treatment, whether your taxes are paid correctly. I mean, is it just ultimately that we're moving towards singularity, which means that, the computer becomes us or better than us?
What I wonder is, and I haven't been able to find it. I don't know
exactly where it is, but, you go to the grocery store and you buy this, and this, and it prints out coupons because you bought this once before.
Right.
Where's the button that says, I didn't like that stuff? Send it back. I don't want your coupon.
That's a really good point. So it's all about, they think what we want based on our habits, but they're telling us what we want. It's not that, hey, I might have purchased it at one point, but it really sucked and I don't want it again. They don't care about that. It's just you're in a database so that they can market to you. And even a sicker thing I read this morning, that in Australia and New Zealand, Facebook has some sort of way to determine the mood of young children, well, teens, and to market to them when they're at their lowest point. So, I mean, this is...
It's old party ring that turns pink if you're...
Yeah, the mood ring?
Yeah,
mood ring. This is even more proactive, though. They have a way to make you sad, right? They can, use phrases and... hashtags, whatever they do, that can actually elicit the emotion. And then when the child is feeling sad, and they have this thing, they're usually sad during the week they are, going to school productive. The weekend is when they get together with their friends and they, basically try to one up each other how awesome they are. And there's a point in their week where they're not feeling so good about themselves, and this is the time that you need to market to them. I mean, it's like the tail wagging the dog almost here. We are at a crossroads between whether we're going to give up our emotional, physical, economic, and everything else autonomy as individuals and have something manage us, manage everything about us. Nothing is as good as you as an individual. You get to run your life, but not in this kind of system. You become, you know, a gigabyte, a metadata, whatever you want to say, you're just part of a whole. And anything that makes you different is a problem. It's all started, honestly. I'm starting to see the confluence of where we've gone over the past 20 years where, you know, when you're an individual, that was a great thing. Now the individual is the outlier. You know, you're not supposed to have a thought of your own. You're not supposed to be different because somehow that offends somebody else or you hurt somebody else or you're, I don't even know what to say. Because it's so counter to how I was, you know, brought up. And I'm sure you too. And I think most people over the age of 40 are having issues with making this change, you know, where your value is based on a like. Your value is based on some entity telling you that you should like not having as much or like paying more for healthcare, whatever the thing is they're trying to get us into line with that we're just ignoring. I mean, it's really, maybe that's why people are so unhappy, because they're not sure exactly why they're unhappy, but they know that they are. And having more things doesn't make you happy, or having the newest iPhone doesn't make you happy, or having the most friends on Facebook. I mean, it's just gotten so many, it's gotten so out of control, and it's been insidious, so no one's really seen it. But there's an issue. I think it's a real disconnect. I mean, I did a lot of, for whatever reason, a lot of articles have come across in the last week that have opened my eyes to this. There's another one about your child and their feeling of disassociation and loneliness, and it's tied to how much computer use they have. And if you don't socialize your child below the age of 3, they will not become socialized. They won't know how to have human interactions and human bonds. They'll be really bad at it. You wonder, is that the autism issue that's popping up as well? Or the Asperger issue where people have, they can't communicate emotionally with each other? Just imagine a whole society of people, children, who've had the iPhones, you know, taped to their stroller and all these phones that they've, you know, the child knows how to work the phone better than the parent. There is something that's going to, There's a problem with that. We're not quite seeing it, but it's coming. It's like this tidal wave that's about to come.
I don't know if you saw it or not, and I can't remember the exact number, but it was an incredible number of people in New York City that can't change a light bulb.
Yeah. I don't know how that's even possible.
They have to call an electrician. Anything. And we're living with built-in obsolescence. The manufacturer, the one that the chase that gets me is the one between the operating systems and the software that we buy.
Yeah.
If you don't have this operating system, well, you can't run this software. But if you have this and you're tied in, and it's like they're working against you no matter what.
Oh, they absolutely are. What happened in the days when you bought, what is it, Microsoft Word, and you bought the package, and
yeah,
it was good forever.
Yeah.
Office, thank you. Now it's online. Now you have to license it every year, and they're just making you pay for something. They've monetized us in every form, every fashion. We've become things to advertise to, customers to sell things to, but we're not allowed to have our own autonomy if they have it their way. Once they get you as a debt slave and they get you as, you know, they educate you from pre-K out to college, they've pretty much got you trapped in this system where you don't know another system. We happen to know another system, but we're not going to be here forever. And what happens to the people coming behind us? I don't think the parents are necessarily teaching their children what they did or what they know. You know, simple things, how to change a tire, how to change a light bulb. Come on, Dave. That doesn't even make sense.
No, I'm serious.
I read it, too. It's just,
yeah.
What?
Well, we do a whole show on, as you know, on classic cars. And the reason that we even started the show was to get young people, you know, you and I grew up, we relied on a big, thick thing called a history book. And it talked about the importance of Henry Ford. It talked about the importance of what cars have done to the nation or for the nation. Today, you hit it, changing a tire. A kid doesn't know how to change a tire.
No.
A kid doesn't know what's under the hood. Okay. So the show is dedicated to not, we don't want everybody to own a classic car. I mean, it'd be nice if they did, but that ain't going to happen. But at least to be able to appreciate the importance of cars in the United States. The cars made the United States. Being able to go from Oklahoma to California, Oklahoma to New York.
It's freedom, Dave.
It was freedom, yeah.
It's what it's all about. It's about to be able to pick up and do what you're big enough to do. Whether that means take a job across country, drive across country, take a flight somewhere. It's all about putting us in a grid. This is everywhere. It's so, I mean, it's like one day it just all started to be, you know, frozen into place. We had, what, TSA and all this nonsense. Now they have, what is it, global entry if you're going outside the country. I mean, they make it so awful. I mean, just think about what happened in the last 3 years, right? They brought on TSA PreCheck. Nobody wanted to do it at all. I balked at it myself. Like, I'm not giving you my information. Then remember they had all those days where people were outside the airport lines upon lines because they didn't have enough TSA agents. That's when their number of people picked up of who wanted to get TSA PreCheck. Now there's so many people in the TSA PreCheck line, it's just as long as the regular line. Now they come up with something different. What's this one called? Clear. That's it. So now you have to give more information. You give your biometrics, your eye, your retina scan, your fingerprints, and that gets you past the TSA PreCheck line. I mean, that's more information you have to give for the global entry, you know, but this is all make it as inconvenient and as unpalatable as possible, and then bam, you have something to help it ease it. And next thing you know, you've given up more of your personal information. Now you're giving up your biometrics. I never thought I would ever do something like that.
You know, it's in the Bible, and it's the Bible missed it because they said it was going to be basically a tattoo. It's not going to be a tattoo.
No.
It'll be a chip. Everybody has to have a chip.
Or an identification number or something where you needed to enter the system, whether that be get on the internet or travel. I mean, there's no way on earth that I'm going to get any kind of car that drives itself. Are you insane? What happens when it gets hacked and you can't do anything about it? Or it drives you to a place you don't want to go? I mean, all the things that nobody thinks about what could happen. You know, this is the...
Oh, it'll never happen with it.
Yeah, okay. What about those Uber people who are getting these Uber cars and God knows what happens to you? But even if nothing physically happens to you, they have your credit card information and where you live. And there were stories about people getting their houses broken into by Uber drivers. There just needs to be a little bit more thought about what could happen. What if? And it's always the same presentation. We're just going to make it easier. We're going to cure cancer. We're going to find missing children. Just give it up because we're going to try to help everybody. What happens when they take it one step further? No one ever thinks about that. It's not just the children. It's everybody. Someone who didn't pay their taxes, they're going to hunt you down. Or you didn't pay your mortgage. Something benign that's not a criminal, horrible offense, you're actually going to get picked up too. Or you can't leave the country. Or they'll turn off your passport. All the things that will capture you. Just in a dystopian way, this is a healthcare show. What if you don't take a vaccine? And that's in your medical information, your health information technology. Well, now it's mandatory all of a sudden, and you didn't do it. And everybody's going to know about it. Maybe you won't be able to leave the country because you're a health risk. Maybe you can't get a job for the government. You know, all sorts of things that can work against you down the road. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. You know, I was taking my analogy to the extreme, but I don't think it's all that extreme because it only needs one person or one entity who can see the control, how much they can monetize it, get in the ear of Congress, or better yet, the pocket of Congress, and make it happen. Think about how the drug companies work. Think about what they've done to this point.
Now, you're a lot younger than I am. But from my standpoint, I would have never dreamed when I was 10 years old, 12 years old, that I'd be sitting here or you'd be sitting there behind a computer that has more information in it than either one. I can't absorb what the computer has. But did you ever think that it just wasn't there? But what you're saying now, what sounds like fiction today,
exactly,
is reality tomorrow.
Very true. When I was in college and we had to write our thesis, we didn't have personal computers. We had to go to the computer center. And we had
and
to print
cards?
It out. Oh, my God.
Punch cards?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And then we had to print out our work on these long. I mean, it would just, you'd have to fold it, tear the thing off. It was ridiculous. Now, it's like a whole new world. I mean, we've just made that seamless transition, but we still know what it was. I can still write. I still know how to tell time with the hands of a clock. These people can't even tell time anymore.
We do.
Yeah, we do.
But kids today...
That's a problem.
You and I have a very pretty handwriting, cursive, or whatever.
They don't even know how to do cursive.
They don't even teach it.
No. So think of all the things that you can... If we ever had something where the power went out, we have an enormous amount of people who would be learned helpless, just victims of whatever's coming down the pipe. They can't even start a fire. They can't cook. They can't do anything to survive. They don't know how to grow food. They don't know. They don't know how to find places without their GPS. I mean, this is just—it's brilliant and sick all at the same time. But it's on us. Just because it's easier doesn't make it better. I don't even microwave things anymore. One, I don't think it's safe, and two, it doesn't taste good. Heat it up on the stove or in the oven like the old days. I don't eat anything that's got to have to nuke, popcorn or anything. Whatever's been spoon-fed to us for ease. In the long run, has not helped us. In the short term, and in moderation, there's nothing wrong with anything. We're not talking moderation anymore. We're talking about people who get depressed, who get bullied online, for example. Turn off the computer. How on earth do you get bullied online? I don't even understand that. In the old days, they'd meet you after school, and you go for it, right? Change your username. I don't even understand how that works. And people are hurting themselves. Now we have Facebook where people are videotaping, or I should say streaming themselves, hurting themselves. And that's become a new fad.
But wouldn't you have to be a masochist to be bullied online? To go back and go back to the, you know, whoever it is or whatever it is or, you know, whatever the circumstance, you still make the decision to go back and have dirt thrown in your face.
I think it all comes down to your valuing, you perceive your value by what other people think about you. And they don't even know you. That's the thing. That's the difference between having some sort of nucleus of individuality. We're all different. We're not better. We're just different. So if you don't like me, you don't like the color of my hair, you don't like the way I talk, then I'm going to find someone else that does. You don't matter. But in this system, it's a top-down approach. It's a centralized approach. There is some central... It's getting larger, actually. It's the entity, mind, hive, whatever you want to call it, that's deciding what normal is, what good is, what constitutes being a good person or a good citizen, and has nothing to do with ethics or morals or reality. And I think the longer you stay in that virtual world, I mean, we have people who literally have virtual boyfriends, want to get married to robots. I mean, this is not normal on any level because they can't interact with humans. And or they don't love, but I think it comes down to not loving yourself, actually. But because you don't, you want no one else to be happy. It's the ultimate hater. Someone took it from you, someone who worked hard, somehow that's somehow demeaning you in some way. And instead of you working harder or being happy for the person, you want to destroy them. That's the whole method to this madness. And I think you can extrapolate it out, and we're going to get a little probably weird, but I think it's still a connection. The corporatization is the same thing. The corporate structure is really afraid and does not like the individual entrepreneur mind. The person who can sit and think of something and make it reality, whether that's a business, art, whatever it is. That is contra to the corporate mindset, which is to take on everybody's talent, co-opt it, monetize it, and make the person pay for it. They do it all the time. Medicine's a perfect example. The hospitals are a corporate entity that uses doctors, nurses, and everybody in between in order to make money, in order to make themselves too big to fail, in order to get rid of the competition, in order to work with other pharmaceutical entities so that you have a disease, you have a way to treat it, you're monetizing the medications, you've got your formulary, so only the brand names or in the most expensive meds are going to be pushed through. It's the bigger picture. Who stands to gain is all you have to ask yourself.
Is the person that you're describing that hates themselves and hates everybody else, hates anybody's success, are they the ones that pick up the weapons and go on a shooting spree?
I think those folks I think they're sick. I mean, I think that the number one, I say the common denominator for all these folks that I've ever heard of is they're on a medication. They're on an psychotropic or a psychotropic medication of some sort. Does that, you know, loosen their inhibitions? Does that make them more likely to act out? Does that mess with their brain chemistry so that you trigger them? Question mark. They're all kind of the same. Loners, people who have been bullied, people who have a grudge. But this society is based on grudges all of a sudden. You can't just be an American. You have to be a hyphenated American, and you have to be a victim of some sort. Some other group did something to you, and you have to get justice, and you're going to use social justice to get it. Antifa, that's total, needs to be removed. Black Lives Matter, these are all just constructs. And they're all driven and underwritten and paid for by the same people who stand to gain. If we all hate each other, we cannot look at what's going on that affects all of us. Healthcare affects all of us. Taxes affects all of us. Our government affects all of us. We're all being manipulated. What you can control is how you perceive it and what you do about it. I decided I don't want to play this game anymore. I don't really care. I don't listen to the news so much anymore. And if I do, I turn it off as soon as it gets ridiculous, which is not very long these days. It's the same story over and over. How many times are they going to tell us, oh, yes, the healthcare bill is back online. Yes, it's going to be voted on this week. No, they pulled it back because they didn't have support. It's the same shit, excuse me, that they had before the supposed reform effort came on. It's got keeping the kid on the parents' insurance to age 26. It's got everybody paying the same amount whether or not they're sick, which is ridiculous. I remember saw them remove the money for the drug companies and the insurance companies. So they're going to be made whole if they don't make their profit or as much profit. I didn't see that get removed, by the way. And the things that are keeping it expensive haven't been removed. There's no way that I should pay the same as somebody with multiple medical problems. I'm not costing the system the same. Why should I pay more? That's ridiculous. Have a separate system, and I don't have a problem with the government paying for it, but it would be less money because these people are not that many in the country. There may be, I think it was like 8%. It was a very small number. But to extrapolate that out through the entire system makes everybody pay dramatically more when you can just cover these people separate in a separate pool. They don't want to do that. They don't want you to be able to have disposable income that you can use for something else. They want you to pay it for premiums. They want you not to be able to use it when you really need it because your deductible is crazy. They don't care. If you think anybody single payer, anybody who loves the government insurance, think they give two darns about your health care, you're insane. And you will find out, and I pray that you don't, if you get sick and you actually need something. You need the cancer drug. You need the bone marrow transplant. You need the balloon sinus dilation surgery. You're not getting it because they're going to tell you that it's too expensive and you're not worthy. That's a problem. And until unless we start taking our own power back, I want to pay for my own needs because I get to determine what they are. Just leave me alone and let me know what the cost is, and I'll find the best way to get the job done. I don't need you to tell me what it is. And unfortunately, it ends up being a two-tier system where those who need it the most really do get the less. They get less of it, and they get drugged out of their mind. I'll give the story again. I'm giving it multiple times at this point. But the children on Medicaid that I've taken care of in the hospital setting, in a clinic setting, 99% of them were on at least one psychotropic drug. You can't tell me that Medicaid children have a need for all these ADD, ADHD, antipsychotic drugs, every single one. What happens to those children's brains as they progress, as they get older? What are they lacking that we don't, that we're going to find out eventually? What is it? It's not normal. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Dr. George, before we go on break, I want to make one quick announcement. I'm sure everybody's heard about the tornadoes in Texas, and they did affect us. Michael Connolly called this morning that his home was hit in Canton. So our Constitution will be a bit delayed for the next couple of weeks. We'll be back right after this.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose, and with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Today I'm having, as I spoke about at the beginning of the show, I was having a guest to come on to give her expertise about what she sees as the advent, where we are now with health information technology, and where what we need to be concerned about in the future. I'd like to welcome Dr. Vanila Singh. She is a clinical associate professor for the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative, and Pain Medicine at Stanford University, and she's also vice chairman of the National Physicians Council on Healthcare Policy. And one of the things that I wanted you to talk about, Dr. Singh, is the fact that you have intimate knowledge of where we're going because you are a subcommittee health information technology member and the California Medical Association. So you're actually on the front line. Most of us just kind of pick it up after it's come online, but you've been in from the beginning, haven't you?
That's right. Thank you, first of all, for having me on your show, Dr. George. It's honestly a pleasure to speak with you again. And I think that you are right on in considering this very important topic that has made its way into the very common practices now for doctors and is moving at such a speed that there is little in the way so far of consideration in terms of the impact it's had on the physician workflow, the doctor-patient relationship, time that is devoted to the EMR versus actually time in terms of speaking with the patient and examining them. So there have been great consequences. This is felt by a majority of physicians who are in the field regardless of where they're practicing and what type of practice model they have.
Oh, I agree. I've been in the hospitals and tried to chart just orders after surgery, and it's taken over half an hour just to do that. And it's just, it feels, it just takes your happiness away because you're so busy dotting I's, crossing T's. And it's one of the reasons I really, really rarely have to go to the hospital, and I don't want to because it's a chore now.
That's right. And I think that sentiment is felt so commonly by practicing doctors as well as our patients, because that time that is being placed into the electronic medical record, which has been touted as a means to be efficient, has rather turned into an onerous burden of coming along with compliance issues related more to billing and coding rather than patient care. Of course, as you know, the medical chart originally was there, our handwritten notes and whatnot, mm-hmm. were more for the doctor's ability to keep track of what was going on, sort of follow the plan, revisit old notes. But in the manner that the model is now, it is not with that primary intent in mind. Rather, it has been something that seems to have overtaken the small, already pressured time that is there for the patient doctor to interact. And then, of course, like you mentioned, for achieving the tasks later, simple things like giving orders, placing orders in the patient chart, mm-hmm. Trying to order medications, trying to document things. The documentations on an EMR template often have very little meaning. Each page seems to look the same. And then there's so many records that are put in there by all other ancillary providers that the chart itself is huge, large, and there's simply no reasonable amount of time to go and sift through things for the patient. So I think that there's a lot of issues that are at stake currently. I will also add to your listeners that one of the big issues and topics that is circling health information technology right now in EMR records is interoperability, which is simply a term that if you are having EMR records, then you should be able to have those shared. And, of course, that brings up other issues such as the patient's right to their own data and privacy, which all goes to HIPAA laws.
It just seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, were there doctors that were in on the ground level of creating this? Because it's just all these companies, these entities that saw doctors and patients as a means to making money and a means to making themselves important, but it has nothing to do with the actual workflow. They don't get it. I mean, that was the whole point of high tech, wasn't it? Was to have our information, patient, doctor information, in a way that we could access it without, like, seamlessly, no matter where you were. And that is farthest from the truth right now.
That's right. And I think that situation is so variable. I hear this every day, almost, from doctors that I work with, but certainly across different models, whether it is private practice models, small group practices, larger group practices, the EMR has taken over. And quite honestly, it seems as though it has become more the important issue and the patient care side of things, the actual human interaction from a doctor to a patient and vice versa, is incidental. Mm-hmm. In this small amount of time that we have for follow-ups and new patient visits, the doctors often found with their back to the patient because they're earnestly trying to get the information into the electronic medical record. And the reason that that has to happen is because otherwise doctors are found to be doing this off hours in a manner that's just not feasible. No. And so I think that what the real solution forward is to make a demand doctors have been had to acquiesce to these models rather than the models having to fit around doctors' workflow. That is something that we need to speak about more openly. We need to also ensure that our patients' data is protected, that the patients have rights in this new era of the EMR, and that, in fact, at the end of the day, they also have ownership that follows them. I think that's the most important thing in terms of integrity and ensuring that their data is protected. Of course, all these issues bring up cybersecurity issues, mm-hmm. which we know are a big issue even with the government. So certainly, how do we expect that these companies can guarantee that the patient's healthcare information, which is sensitive and certainly can be used malignantly against them, how is it going to be guaranteed in protection? So this era of technology has, if the horse has left the barn, and just because we can doesn't mean we should, and we certainly have to proceed with more caution. And doctors, as well as patients, are going to have to speak out and speak for each other. Mm-hmm. The patients want their doctors to have the time to consider their issues, which is the whole purpose of what's going on, is healthcare for the people. And the doctors are going to have to speak out on behalf of their ability to take care of those very patients. It goes right back down to our oath of practice.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And, you know, the onus right now, I think, needs to switch. In terms of HIPAA, if the patient's information is breached, it's the doctor that's on the hook, right? It's not the electronic medical record vendor, is it?
That's right. And I think that they need to be brought into the forefront. They are providing the service, and they have an accountability that goes with that. As with everything, it is, at the end of the day, thought to be the physician's responsibility on all fronts. It's almost impossible to secure a system that we had no part in developing, mm-hmm. we had no part in deciding, and something that we all feel, for the most part, has impeded our workflow and our ability to take care of patients. So I think that the vendors have to be brought in. There has to be accountability. And these are issues that, again, it goes across specialties, it goes across practice models, and I hope that this is something that we can seamlessly advance. The only issue that I see is that a lot of the folks who should be speaking on behalf of the physicians and medical organizations have been either slow to catch on or have simply looked the other way, because there's a big business in technology. Yeah. And much of that technology now is focused on health information technology. It's become a very, very large entity of technology, and being developed by folks who simply do not know what it is to take care of patients. They are simply not in the practice of medicine, and it is dangerous. They just simply don't know what they don't know.
That's true. And with that in mind, how can doctors take our power back? Should we go to these conferences? Should we join the subcommittee for health information technology in our state like you did for yours? What can we do to get in the mix now?
Absolutely. So everything, all of the above. I mean, part of the reason I've stayed involved with organizations that I'm not sure have actually protected the doctor-patient relationship, but what I also realize is that we may have complaints and issues, and we see problems, but there is simply, in this day and age, no way to stay out of the policy side of things. Mm-hmm. It is incumbent on doctors to take part in their state societies, the greater medical organizations, to lend their voices with op-eds, to be on programs like yours, and to engage with our patients and to come up with those solutions, advance those very strongly in the interest of the patient. That's the whole reason why we are in our profession. And I would implore those who are listening, whether they are doctors of any specialty or background, and if they are patients of any background of issue, to see if there's a constructive way that they can also get involved. I mean, patients have a very vital role here. Mm-hmm. If they have issues, if they observe that their doctors are underrun, have very little time, what they may not know is that the doctors have many burdens placed on them, regulations, threats, really, for suspension and whatnot if they're not complying with this. The patients' voices are very strong. If they write to their medical organizations, their lawmakers, state and federal, this is where the trend and the understanding starts to come, and the solutions are a lot more able to take shape. And I would say this, that there are many good folks out there mm-hmm. who are fighting for this, but numbers count. And so it is actually much more feasible than people realize. Write letters, write to your congressmen, to your state senators, to your state assemblymen, to the senators that are at our federal government level, and HHS and everybody, and let them know that these are the things that they're being observed, they want to figure out a way to allow those doctors to have the time and ability to do what they went into medicine for, which is to take care of patients, have the ability to diagnose, treat, and help them along the way and empower the patient.
Absolutely. I mean, I just think about it from the system is supposed to be for us, the doctor and the patient, and we're the ones on the outside looking in. That's always been my complaint about how this has come online and where we're going. And on that note, let's take a small break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're having a very important conversation with Dr. Vanila Singh. She is a clinical associate professor at Stanford University in the Department of Anesthesia, and she's also a policy expert because she's part of the National Physicians Council on Healthcare Policy and part of the Health Information Technology Subcommittee in California's Medical Association. So, Dr. Singh, when you join something like the Health Information Technology in the California Medical Association, what does that give you the ability to do? What has your voice changed or hope to change in that situation?
Well, I think just being a part of a subcommittee shows that these are volunteer positions. Mm-hmm. I think someone had nominated me for it. And rather than back away, I made it a point to try to learn about the field. And in that endeavor, I've attended a couple of conferences. I've given talks just recently with our national meeting in my specialty, which is the American Society of Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine. Mm-hmm. And because of that background, I was invited to speak on issues related to health information technology with MACRA, which is the Medicare and CHIPS Reauthorization Act. And these are things that actually immediately impact doctors with payments. And what's very interesting is that health information technology, EMR, and payment for physicians are all interrelated, mm-hmm. and that these systems have evolved to where they are, and they're going to impact doctors, where many doctors, I think a substantive number of physicians had not even heard of MACRA, tells you that just by getting involved with these subcommittees, whether they in and of themselves are able to accomplish something will be, it remains to be seen, but having your voice there mm-hmm. as a very measured voice with the sole intent to help the doctor-patient relationship so ultimately we can help our patients, that's what the advantage of getting into these committees. Because it also gives you some sense of credibility as you improve your background and knowledge of that field mm-hmm. to speak even at other society meetings. And what I've found recently is that there are more and more doctors who are coming to understand that it's vital to get involved with health policy. So I would say that the one committee or subcommittee in and of itself may have some ability to alter things, but just getting involved with that opens up doors mm-hmm. for speaking as you become an expert so that you can then kind of energize and activate your fellow physicians and your own specialty societies or state medical associations, and certainly with great physician organizations such as the National Physicians Council on Health Policy, where you and I both are members, and that's one that goes across the board, just doctors who really care about their patients. So these are all just a means to get your foot in the door to start speaking. And I always say this, think not just only of your own practice, but think of how your colleagues are practicing. I'm in academic medicine, which means I'm in the pain clinic, and I've been with EMR for 8 or 9 years with mm-hmm. Epic. And I know I have colleagues in other arenas who are now just adopting EMR at great expense to meet the mandatory needs to get paid. And people are just coming to realize it. So advocate for not just your own situation with your patients, but for the greater situation. It gives more credibility, and it's going to be more effective if we're unified. My situation, my issues at my type of workplace may differ from someone else's who's in a solo practice or small group practice, but I am thinking of those folks as well as what I encounter. And that's how we become unified. And we are still at a state where our society still looks to doctors. And we have been very quiet because we've had so much in the way of burdensome regulations.
Yeah.
And we just simply don't have time. But that no longer, in my view, is really enough of a reason to not do our small part. And I think that it's just a matter of getting more and more momentum. Right now is the time to strike. We have folks who are willing to consider these issues. So I would say to all your listeners, please take this as a time to go look into your state societies and your national societies and see if there's a way to get involved in these committees and to then voice what you're seeing. And always make sure it is first and foremost in the patient's interest. There's no denying those words then. And it is then not a confrontational issue, but a solutions-oriented issue. What can we do for our patients? We know that this is impacting physician workflow. What do we suggest to do that? The vendors are going to have to start considering who are their primary clients. Mm-hmm. Till now, I think it's been hospitals, and it has taken very little into account for things outside of billing and coding. It has to take into account patient care.
Right.
And there are some that are coming into those ways. We need more competition in the area of vendors who are providing EMR, and hopefully those that will consider the doctor as the primary client.
From a patient perspective, what do you counsel patients to become their own advocate on how they need to protect their own healthcare data, or questions that they should be asking so they can be on, you know, informed and protected as much as possible?
Right. I think that's a great question. I mean, that's the crux of it all. I let my patients see the records. You know, sometimes they're like, well, it should be in the record. And then I show them what the records look like on the EMR. The vast number of entries and encounters and notes, it's almost impossible for anyone, particularly those with a lot of health issues, to even comprehend what it would take to go through every one of those records.
Right.
It's not succinct. It's not direct to the point that what for the meat and bones issues that we're looking for. And then they start to understand. And also, to if they show concern, to say, look, these are your records. You have a right to them. You have to also want to ensure that no one else has a right to them, and that they should write to their lawmakers, federal and state, that this is of concern to them. They want to understand what guarantee that they have that there is a secure system. I know that Sanford takes great means, I mean, huge means for the HIPAA modules, so that every year we are re-educated in it. But at the end of the day, what is concerning to cybersecurity and all measures across the spectrum isn't just what we do to secure our patient data, the systems that we have in place, the firewalls, but it's rather those people on the outside, the hackers, who do it for nefarious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that in our control? No. So we have to demand what is going on. We also have to demand that should we give permission to our doctors, they should have easy ability to go and get that information or health EMR records.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, some companies and vendors make it challenging to do that because they're trying to block other vendors from getting access to their place. And there's a lot of these issues that are going on. They're simply in the primary means to enable those vendors to keep their market share. And you know, they're coming into the healthcare space. And they're not doing it for the doctors or the patients. So we have to demand that. We have to put that on. There should be our policy position.
Agreed.
And you and I had spoken about this recently in Washington, D.C., and we're hoping to get a patient bill 2.0, if you will, passed with regard to HIPAA and health IT.
Well, that'd be awesome. And I can tell you personally, I've had that experience switching vendors I'm private, and I've had an EMR since 2001, one of the first I'd guessed. But they tried to charge me $10,000 just to transfer the patient information from one vendor to another. There needs to be something done about that. I mean,
that's
that was
right.
just outrageous.
That's exactly right. It impedes patient care.
Yeah.
It impedes it. I mean, and to put the onus on the physician to do that is just, it's a real corporate game, and we need more competition in that arena.
Mm-hmm.
I think competition is healthy because they will then buy for your business, for you to seek their EMR, right, vendor? And when that happens, they're also willing to then ensure your workflow is better for you.
Right.
That it actually is saves time, makes it better for you to have more time with your patient, with records that are actually applicable. They're more relevant to what you're doing, that they're not just simply for billing and coding and things like that,
mm-hmm.
but rather for your ability to take better care of your patients. I think that's all it comes down to. So I think it's just a call to be active. And for a long time now, we've had a tradition of not being active as doctors. The last 8 years have changed that to some degree, but it can actually change a lot more. And I would encourage, again, your listeners to consider the National Physicians Council on Health Policy. Our patron and sponsor is Honorable Pete Sessions, Congressman from Dallas, who's the chair of the Powerful Health Rules Committee, and a true friend to doctors who has taken it upon himself to want to see how he can assist us by having this council, and we meet in D.C., and I know that if folks are interested, they should definitely reach out to you, Dr. George, as well as myself, and we'd be happy to guide them to how to become more involved in that organization if what we're saying resonates with them.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, and I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day. I know you're probably between patients and everything like that, so I really want to thank you for your time and your expertise. And in the last 15 seconds or so that we have, is there any conference, health information technology conference, that you would recommend that people go to?
Well, that's a great question. There are a lot of different conferences going on. One of the big ones is the health information. It's called HIMSS, and it's done annually, but they also have small ones. It's HIMSS. I went there. There is very little in the way of doctor presence,
mm-hmm.
but going to one of their main ones or some subgroup one would be important, just as at least as a one-time thing to understand how large this industry has become. And how they believe their algorithms are going to cure medicine without any real sense of what, in fact, the practice of medicine is, what the variable issues that exist with our patients, how patients differ in physiology and genetics and chemistry and whatnot, that they think that, you know, we're similar to machines. I don't think it's a malintent, but it's a lack of understanding. And then, of course, I think all of the large medical societies now are starting to see that health information technology is relevant. So I would go online and do that, but I would say we would help guide them in the National Physicians Council on Health Policy to give them sort of direction if they want into
okay.
their local county, state, and national societies. And I would say that there's also some independent physician practices. There's the Independent Physicians for Patient Independence that fight large entities that are basically making a huge onerous burden on physician practices, particularly small practices like your own, which are really our neighborhood doctors who have the great relationships with their patients and know their patients individually. There are many, many places we can certainly help guide them to those things. And if you go online, there's the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons that are also very active, the American College of Physicians. Those are places that they'll find very physician-driven, true, devoted doctors to patients.
You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.